With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On June 5th, 1986, 4-year-old Jessica Gutierrez climbed into bed with her then 6-year-old sister, Becky. The next morning, Jessica was nowhere to be found. While her mother, Deborah, searched the home frantically, she received a disturbing account from Becky. According to the child, Jessica had been taken during the night by a man wearing what she called a magic hat. Outside of that description and a single fingerprint, authorities had little to work with. A bitter dispute built up over the years between Deborah, the sheriff's department, and the solicitor's office. Deborah felt her daughter's case hadn't been handled properly since day one, and demanded to know why, after the fingerprint was matched to a person of interest, no charges were ever filed. 33 years have passed since Jessica Gutierrez was taken from her bed, and still, her abductor remains uncharged. A desperate mother stands amidst a case filled with suspicion, doubt, corruption, and accusations of a cover-up. Who took Jessica Gutierrez, and why, all of these years later, have no charges been filed despite the presence of evidence? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 97, The Abduction of Jessica Gutierrez. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine a 33-year-old abduction. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today we examine the abduction of Jessica Gutierrez, a case which may be as much about the politics behind the investigation as much as the investigation itself. This is Episode 97, The Abduction of Jessica Gutierrez. Jessica Suzanne Gutierrez was born on December 3, 1981, to parents Deborah and David. Jessica, often referred to as Jessie, was the baby of the family, having older siblings, both male and female. When Jessie was 2 years old, her parents would divorce and David moved away, spending some time in Mexico City and later in California. Lexington, South Carolina, a suburb of the state capital of Columbia, would become home to Jessie and her family, living in the community of Red Bank. Deborah was a hard-working single mother, driven to provide her children with the best possible opportunities and care. While she loves all of her children, that's been made extremely clear through her actions and words over the years, it's also not a shock to any family that the baby of the family often gets the primary focus. However, in the case of Jessie, that focus would sadly become about recovering her and finding the answers to very hard questions. Jessie was a sweet little girl, and in photographs her smile still beams out from beneath her wavy brown hair. A loving child, animated and full of life, photos of her still hang on the wall, delivering flashes of memory both of how she was and the painful wonder of how she may have become. Only 4 years old at the time of her disappearance, Deborah never got to see the woman Jesse would grow into, nor the life she may have chosen to lead. Instead, in the middle of the night, an unknown assailant would forever alter the course of the Gutierrez family, and now, 33 years after her abduction, the search for Jesse and the hunger for justice have reached a point of desperation. It was the spring of 1986. Temperatures were rising and Lexington had completed the transition from the cold winds of winter to the gentle showers of early June. Jesse, 4 years old at the time, shared a bed with her older sister, Becky, in the family's mobile home. Oftentimes, the four-year-old would request to sleep with her mother, and Deborah almost always acquiesced. On June 4th, Jesse had spent the night sleeping beside her mother, but the next evening, when she made the same request, Deborah would tell her that, since her older brother had an ear infection, he was going to sleep with her that night, and she would be joining her sister Becky, as per usual. Thursday, June 5th, 1986, was a typical day for the Gutierrez family. The children and Deborah had spent their time working outside, getting things done around the yard. Up until recently, Deborah had been dating a man, but things hadn't worked out. Deborah would later explain that she felt the man was too possessive and controlling, and that his taste for alcohol had been a troubling situation. And so, just days earlier, she had told him to leave her home. Now it was back to the core family, to Deborah and her children, and the weight of that struggle had been left behind, or so Deborah believed. However, this would be the last day Deborah would have with Jesse, and she had no way of knowing just how difficult and painful her life was going to become. After working in the yard, the family came inside to get cleaned up and have dinner before going to bed. That evening, Deborah had prepared BLT sandwiches, and so they gathered together and, according to Deborah, there wasn't the slightest hint of anything out of the ordinary. In a statement to thestate.com, Deborah would later explain, quote, "Everything was normal. I painted Jesse's nails that night. She asked to sleep with me," end quote. Due to her brother being sick, Jesse crawled into the double bed she shared with Becky sometime between 11:30 and midnight. What occurred between the hours of midnight and 9 a.m. remains a mystery with a bizarre set of clues. At approximately 9 a.m. on the morning of Friday, June 6th, Deborah heard Becky calling out, requesting cereal for breakfast. As Deborah got out of bed, she quickly discovered things were amiss in the home. The front door was open and the family dog was inside, wandering around the house. As she entered the children's bedroom, she found papers scattered on the floor. Immediately, Deborah asked where Jesse was since she was not lying in bed with Becky. In what can only be described as both disturbing and mysterious, Becky replied, "She's gone. The man with the magic hat and the beard took her." Assuming that Becky, being six, was just pretending, Deborah pulled down the covers from the bed thinking she'd find Jesse hiding there, but she wasn't in the bed. Deborah began searching the home, calling out for Jesse, but everywhere she looked, there was no trace of the four-year-old. As she continued searching, she eventually made the discovery that a set of curtains had been ripped down from one of the windows, and it was evident that someone had pulled the screen out and entered the home through that window. Frantic and panicked, Deborah returned to the bedroom and began questioning Becky, but the six-year-old wasn't able to provide any answers that made sense. Becky went on to explain that the man with the magic hat and beard had entered their room during the night, lifted Jesse out of the bed without even waking her, and then exited the room. When asked why she hadn't called for help or done anything to get the attention of her mother, Becky explained that she had been paralyzed by fear and she must have fallen back asleep at some point. What time this happened remains unknown, though it isn't difficult to imagine a six-year-old both being too afraid to cry out and not being able to stay awake after having been awoken in the middle of the night. At that point, Deborah picked up the phone and made a frantic call to 911 to report her four-year-old daughter missing. The responding agency would be the Lexington County Sheriff's Department. Deborah was interviewed by the Sheriff's Department, and while they took her statement, officers were dispatched to the home to begin the process of gathering evidence and searching for the missing child. Not long after that call, Deborah dialed up her ex-boyfriend that she'd recently kicked out of the home and demanded to know where her daughter was. She later recalled that the ex had responded with surprise, saying that he had no idea where Jesse could be and that he didn't take her. The man would also ask Deborah why she was calling him and if Jesse was missing. And while he would forever deny his involvement, from that moment forward, Deborah always believed that he knew more than he was saying, telling reporters, quote, "To this day, in my gut of guts and my heart of hearts, I know he's involved," end quote. While investigators were not able to determine much about the abduction from examining the scene, they did come up with at least one vital clue, which to this day remains a source of debate and controversy. Crime scene technicians were able to lift a single fingerprint from the window that had been forced open by the abductor. At the time, the fingerprint was submitted to the FBI, though no matches were made. This was a case which would quickly involve multiple departments, as by the day after Jesse's abduction, both the FBI and the State Law Enforcement Division, or SLED, contributed to the investigation. Then Lexington County Sheriff James Metz confirmed to the Times and Democrat newspaper that SLED officers had arrived on Saturday, June 7th, to relieve county investigators who had been working nonstop. Investigators took several steps early on to try and determine what may have happened. Initially, the family was considered a possibility in terms of the abduction, with some wondering if the abduction accusation may have been levied to cover up some other crime. In order to monitor the home and to possibly pick up on a call from a potential ransom demand, the Lexington County Sheriff's Department placed a wiretap on the family phone. This wiretap would later reveal the exceedingly disturbing conversation between Deborah and Sheriff Metz, and perhaps give an indication of how the investigation was handled. However, for the time being, all calls were being monitored, though none appeared to lead to any significant developments, and there never was a ransom demand. Another action taken by authorities was to try and track down Jesse's father, David Romero Gutierrez Ruiz, who hadn't been around since 1983. With little to go on, investigators discovered that while he had been living in Mexico City for a time, he was no longer out of the country, and ultimately he was located in California. Several discussions with David led investigators to rule him out as a potential suspect, as he had a solid alibi. He was in California during the time that Jesse was taken. While David himself was ruled out, there was still consideration of Deborah's feelings about the case, that her recent ex-boyfriend may have known more than he admitted to. Investigators did follow up on him and reportedly had multiple discussions with him regarding Jesse, but were never able to make any connections between that man and the abduction. In 1987, 1 year after the abduction, Deborah received a glimmer of hope when law enforcement officers in Kansas found a young child they believed could possibly have been Jesse. Deborah flew to Kansas to make an identification, but it would ultimately turn out to be a different child. When speaking to thestate.com, Deborah explained, quote, "That was horrible. I heard her voice before I even got to the two-way mirror to look at her, and I said, that's not her," end quote. There was, of course, another man that Deborah felt could have been involved. In fact, she would argue that this other man could have been working with her ex-boyfriend, and the entire abduction could have been something they planned together. I should make note at this time, neither the ex-boyfriend nor this other potential person of interest have ever been named in the public. I was able to track down a name who I believe is this person of interest, but I'm not going to share it with you since it's never been shared publicly. He's a registered sex offender, and if you really want to find him, it's not that difficult. This new possibility was actually a friend of the family, someone it was believed could have known how to gain easy access to the home. However, what truly makes this man pop on the radar of investigators and Deborah was the trouble he got into just weeks after Jesse's abduction. The so-called family friend was 27 years old and from West Columbia, not that far from Lexington itself, and several weeks after the abduction took part in a series of crimes. Firstly, this individual stole a van from Lexington, which he then drove into North Carolina. Once in the state, this individual proceeded to the home of a woman, where he forced his way in while she slept, allegedly through a window. After gaining entry to the home, the man then raped the female homeowner and fled. When later arrested, this man was charged and found guilty, being sentenced to serve time in North Carolina. His story, however, and his possible connection to Jesse's abduction does not end there. While serving time, this man allegedly confessed to his cellmate that in 1986, he had abducted a young girl from her home in Lexington, South Carolina. The man's cellmate ultimately told authorities about the confession and gave additional details. Firstly, that the man had claimed to have murdered the child he abducted burying her remains in a landfill in Lexington County. Beyond that, he claimed to have been wearing a cowboy hat at the time of the abduction. Could that be the magic hat that Jesse's sister remembered seeing in the middle of the night? It keeps going from there, by the way. Beyond telling authorities, the man's cellmate also mailed a letter to Deborah explaining in detail what this man had confessed to him. According to multiple articles in The State, The Times Democrat, and for WIS News 10, it was reported that law enforcement did meet this man to question him about the statements he allegedly made to his cellmate. According to Deborah Gutierrez, at that time, the man offered to tell them everything they wanted to know about the crime in exchange for immunity. Immunity was declined, and the man refused to speak. It's important to note that the contents of that conversation between law enforcement and the man have never been 100% confirmed by investigators nor the district attorney's office. However, Deborah has been exceedingly outspoken about it. What perhaps really makes a connection for Deborah was that, while her ex-boyfriend told her and authorities that he had no connection to the family friend, in fact, he claimed to have never even met him, Deborah said that the two men had met and spoken at a get-together just weeks before the abduction. Investigators did search a landfill in Lexington County following the cellmate's account, but no traces of Jesse were found. Deborah would later state that while she had been suspicious of this man all along, she had found a vehicle associated with him that he had abandoned. Deborah claimed that while searching that particular vehicle, she found fibers associated with Jesse. Though the detail and nature of that finding has never been revealed, nor has an answer been officially given as to why the mother of an abducted child was out doing investigative work rather than the law enforcement professionals who should have been doing it. So, I imagine you might be thinking that this is a very odd situation, but there was little investigators could do. The man allegedly told his cellmate something, requested immunity when questioned about it, and when that offer was denied, there was little more they could do. And you'd be partially right if it wasn't for a key piece of evidence. The fingerprint, the one that was pulled from the window that the abductor had used to enter the home the night Jesse was abducted, matched this man. This is where issues with the investigation itself become a major problem in this case. Deborah Gutierrez has been very vocal about the fact that she believes not only did the Lexington County Sheriff's Department drop the ball on this case, she often felt that it wasn't a top priority. And a dispute between Sheriff Metz and Solicitor Donnie Myers was also a problem. Just for the record, a solicitor is what South Carolina calls a state or district attorney. Reportedly, Sheriff Metz believed that they had enough evidence to move forward with charges while Solicitor Myers disagreed. Sheriff Metz later told WIS News 10, quote, "That's what's frustrating about the case. We felt we've known who it was pretty much a day or two into that case, but we've not been able to convince the solicitor that we need to move forward as far as prosecution is concerned." End quote. When asked about Donnie Myers and the choice not to pursue prosecution, Deborah responded, quote, "What's the problem? The problem fell with Donnie Myers. They're afraid they can't win. I've heard that for years. He's not God. One man that decides who's going to get tried and who isn't is not God. Why don't we get several people in here to look at the evidence?" End quote. That's not all Deborah had been told by people associated with the case. Just 2 weeks into the investigation, Deborah said that an investigator brought up statistics and informed her that the likelihood of Jesse still being alive was fairly slim. And while that's probably true statistically, it's quite a thing for a mother to hear just 2 weeks into the search. Especially a mother who felt like they had a good potential suspect, but no ability to make connections. Even Sheriff Metz himself has stated that they had one person of interest, but not enough to upgrade that person to a suspect. At least, not in the eyes of the solicitor. And while it appeared Sheriff Metz was doing all that he could, a phone call recorded on Deborah's wiretap phone would forever throw a shadow over the investigation and the sheriff himself. In order to make the reading of this transcript easier, I'm going to alter my voice for when I am reading Sheriff Metz's lines versus when I am reading Deborah's lines.
This will be the voice of Deborah.
And this will be the voice of Sheriff Metz. What do you want me to do? Someone's got to hold your hand or out working.
Listen here, I don't need you to hold my hand. I don't need you to get smart with me either.
I'm not going to get smart with you, but you're not going to get smart with me either, lady. I've been up all night long working on your case, and I don't need your smart mouth.
Oh, really?
No.
When I ask you questions, I need answers.
We'll give you answers when we've got answers to give. Now you mess with me, I'll pull all my people off, and we'll go home and go to bed and forget about your case.
What could the president do about that? You mean to tell me that if I mess with you, you would pull all of your people off this case and go home and forget about my child?
That's right.
The conversation does continue beyond that, and yes, those quotes are pulled from an official transcript of the recording of that phone call. Now, while it isn't difficult to imagine that this conversation must have taken place during a heated moment following hours of work for the sheriff, there are few who have read the transcript and feel a great deal of pity towards him. Metz, at the time, had a very good reputation amongst the people of Lexington County and was known as a determined and focused sheriff, though in recent years that perception has been heavily marred. It's also not difficult to imagine why statements such as those would shake Deborah's confidence in the lead investigative body looking into her daughter's abduction. Later in the conversation, Deborah asked the sheriff about the public who voted for him and put him in office, and how they'd feel if they heard him say that, to which he replied,
"They can elect me or not elect me, because I really don't give a darn what they do."
When later asked about this conversation, both Sheriff Metz and Deborah stood on opposite sides of the fence as they had the day the phone call took place. Sheriff Metz later explained, quote, "I never pulled any investigators off this case. In fact, we put more investigators on the case. We had SLED involved with us, so I couldn't pull investigators off if I wanted to. I was very frustrated with Miss Gutierrez because she was accusing me of playing favoritism, and she was accusing me of not handling her case the way it should have been handled, which hurt my feelings." End quote. When the tape of this call was officially revealed by Deborah in 2007, Sheriff Metz questioned the motive, asking why someone would tape a conversation with him 20 years ago. Sheriff Metz, it seems, was either unaware or had completely forgotten that it was his own sheriff's department that had taped that call as part of their wiretap. When asked why she had waited so long to reveal the audio, Deborah expressed that in the years previous, she was concerned that if she publicly took on Sheriff Metz, that he might turn his back on her daughter's case completely. When the audio was played for Metz by WIS News 10, he terminated the interview. Unfortunately, the investigation never did turn up much, at least not much else that was revealed publicly. At one point, Sheriff Metz did tell reporters that some evidence was in the possession of the FBI and that they were waiting for results. The nature of that evidence and the findings of the FBI, were there any, has never been revealed. For Deborah Gutierrez, it was a battle not only to find her daughter and the person responsible, but also to convince investigators to dig deeper while trying to sway a solicitor to move forward with the evidence they possessed. Years after the abduction, Sheriff Metz expressed his frustration, apparently telling Deborah that they had a stronger case back in 1986 when the abduction occurred versus what they had now. Many years into the investigation, Sheriff Metz was asked about the status of the case and his personal thoughts on it. When asked about whether or not they'd ever solved the case, Sheriff Metz stated, quote, "I don't believe Jessica is alive. I think Jesse was taken for a specific reason, and I think that maybe what happened in the case is that things didn't work out the way the abductor thought it was going to work out, and he got scared and then killed Jesse, and then dumped her body here somewhere in Lexington County. I believe that somebody is out there. Maybe they've got a guilty mind. Maybe they're feeling regret or remorse for the situation. Maybe they're willing to come forward and say what happened so there could be closure to this particular case." End quote. Over the past 33 years, the case has had its ebbs and flows. Both Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted ran segments on the abductions between 1986 and 1991. 1991 would also be the year in which a new technology was used to show what Jesse might look like 5 years older, at age 9. Jessica Gutierrez was the first missing child in South Carolina to receive age-progressed photographs. Deborah fought hard to get a new solicitor from another county or someone from a different investigative agency to take over the case, though she claims that Solicitor Myers worked hard to keep that from happening. In 2007, 21 years after Jessica's abduction, the case was examined again by the solicitor's office, and once again, no moves were made towards prosecution. Solicitor Myers stated, quote, "Most of the evidence was inadmissible. The little bit of evidence they had, there was an explanation for," end quote. That seems to be pointing towards the fingerprint, though Deborah has adamantly declared on several occasions that the home's windows were cleaned daily and the fingerprint was recovered and was the only fingerprint found on that window, but it was also certified as fresh by a federal investigator. Myers went on to explain that, without a body, they would need more evidence for a conviction. In June of 2014, 28 years after Jesse's abduction, Sheriff Metz was officially indicted on bribery charges, which, according to the Index Journal, made him the 8th sheriff in the state of South Carolina to be hit with criminal charges in a 4-year window. Then-Governor Nikki Haley suspended Sheriff Metz an hour after the indictments were released. Bill Nettles, a U.S. attorney, told reporters that the sheriff was facing 10 charges of taking bribes, in addition to wire fraud and conspiracy. In October of 2015, testimony from a former town council member led to former Sheriff Metz's decision to submit a guilty plea in regard to the bribery charges, where it was confirmed that he had taken cash bribes in exchange for favors. All the same, while Sheriff Metz had his day in court and his reputation was forever overshadowed, the questions still linger for Deborah and her family. Somewhere out there, an answer exists, and they have a pretty good idea of who could provide those answers, if only the investigation would move forward. She and her family have paid a heavy price in the past 33 years. The struggle, at times, has become overwhelming. Deborah has explained publicly that she harbored resentment towards her daughter Becky for a period of time, but no more. She knows there's only one person, or perhaps two, to blame, and neither is her daughter. Deborah went through a very dark period, canceling Christmas for years after Jesse's abduction, feeling there was nothing left to celebrate. She battled depression, including suicide attempts, and later fell under the pall of prescription drugs. But that's all been put behind her, and her focus remains on discovering the truth of what happened to Jesse. In the years following the abduction, Becky grew up and later had several conversations with investigators describing the night of the abduction and the man responsible, to the best of her recollection. She admitted to intense feelings of guilt for having not done anything at the time, though who could truly hold a 6-year-old responsible for that? A mother herself now, Becky has expressed her own frustrations with the case and this seeming inability to get answers. She stated, quote, "We want them to follow through with what they should have been doing back in 1986. We want justice, closure. This is something we'll have to live with all of our life. But it would be a little easier knowing the person who did this goes to jail and pays for what he's done to my sister, our family." End quote. There are, essentially, only two theories about the abduction of Jessica Gutierrez, both of which have been around since almost the day the abduction took place. The first theory argues that Deborah's ex-boyfriend, who she kicked out of her house just days before the abduction, either played a role in the abduction itself or possesses more information than he has shared. While his possible involvement has remained a sticking point for Deborah, there's never been anything publicly revealed to connect him to the crime. The second theory, and by far the vastly more discussed of the two, argues that this former acquaintance or family friend who allegedly confessed to the crime has been walking around without a murder charge for more than 30 years. There is his supposed confession, a matching fingerprint, and a clear history of violence and sexual assaults. For many, the mystery is less how he could do this, but more how he could never have been charged for it. Jessica Gutierrez is described on her Charlie Project page as being a Caucasian female with brown hair and brown eyes. Jessica has a small scar on her upper forehead and one on her wrist, ear-piercing scars on both of her earlobes, and a small brown birthmark on her right buttock. At the time of her disappearance, Jessica had a wart on her left hand and her nails were freshly painted. She was last seen wearing a pink and white t-shirt and white underwear. At the time of her abduction, Jessica was 3 feet tall and weighed approximately 32 pounds. If alive today, Jessica Gutierrez would be 37 years old, with her 38th birthday coming just next month. While the slow and painful realization exists for the family that Jessica may no longer be alive, age-progressed photographs are available. Deborah Gutierrez and her family have lived with the pain of unknowing, of being just inches from the door of the alleged abductor but unable to reach that door. In an interview, Deborah explained, as a family, they don't discuss the case much. Each family member has their struggles when it comes to dealing with the pain, loss, and trauma. In a 2017 interview, when asked about the case and about Jesse, Deborah replied, quote, "I'm going to hope that she is alive and I'm going to see her again. And until you can show me that my daughter's dead, I'm going to choose to believe that she's alive. That's all I have left. I have that slight bit of a chance of hope, even though, like they say, statistically, this is a very large amount of time, and I'm going to carry that hope until I'm shown otherwise, because I cannot go on if I don't. I fight this every day. It's a battle. I've been fighting for my daughter every single day that she's been gone. This pain, this suffering from Jesse, you know, regardless of what I try to do, I have it. I'm gonna have it forever. I need to find my daughter. I don't know how much time I have left." How many of you have pets? I've always been a dog person myself, but I love animals of all kinds. That's why, when it comes to taking care of my dog, I trust Solid Gold. Solid Gold was the first holistic pet food company in America, started in 1974 by Sissy McGill. Sissy was a trailblazer and a pioneer who disrupted a male-dominated industry and created a natural pet food before it was cool. Solid Gold's nutritional platform is inspired by their beliefs that high-quality food is the best way to impact our pet's mind, body, and spirit. Solid Gold foods cleanse the digestive system with whole superfoods, balance it with living probiotics, and fuel your pet with omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, supporting gut health and nourishing your pet inside and out. Right now, Solid Gold is offering my listeners 30% off your first order by visiting solidgoldpet.com/trace. That's solidgoldpet.com/trace for 30% off your first order. Remember, solidgoldpet.com/trace to save 30% today.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Missing persons cases are always frustrating. Sometimes it's because there's just no evidence. Sometimes it's because there's an abundance of evidence. A missing child case is exceedingly frustrating and difficult, both to investigate and discuss. Here we've got a case where a child goes missing from her own home, and within 48 hours there are two people police are looking at. In less than a year, one of those people is arrested for stealing a vehicle and sexual assault. This same individual has connections to the Gutierrez family, his fingerprint is found at the scene, and he allegedly tells a cellmate all about the crime. Sounds somewhat cut and dry, and yet it's anything but. You've got a sheriff's department at the center of a dispute with Jessica's mother, Deborah. You've got a solicitor who doesn't think they have enough evidence, and a sheriff who thinks they have plenty. All the while, as this is going on, the fate and location of a 4-year-old hangs in the balance, and 33 years later, there's nothing to work with beyond that. How is that possible? How, after all these years with someone in mind that you can tie to the crime scene, how has nothing come out of it? Well, you could be looking at a handful of reasons. This abduction happened in Lexington, South Carolina in 1986. Lexington is about 2 hours from where I live, and I'd never heard of this case. I have friends who've lived in this area their entire lives, and they've never heard of this case. I read countless forum posts and comments on articles from people who were living in Lexington at the time the crime happened, and they had never heard of this case. A four-year-old gets abducted from her home, and while it gets some media coverage, though frankly very little at the time, nobody seems to know about it. My research, in part, involves newspaper archives, and while they don't have every paper ever printed, they've got a lot, and I barely found mention of this case prior to the mid-1990s. The few articles I did find from that time were quite short and left a lot to be desired. The whole situation between the sheriff and the solicitor is just exceedingly frustrating. No attorney wants to go to court with a case they don't think they can win, and while it's difficult to accept that, it's just the truth. Why risk the possibility of letting a child abductor walk free when you might be able to gather more information later? The problem is, nobody did that. I'm not sure what the procedures were with this case, but it blows my mind to see what we know versus what was actually done. And maybe that's a main key to this case, a huge piece of why it's so frustrating, because it seems like it should have been solved. How many cases do you know where they know who did it, but they can't prove it? Sadly, far too many. But this case really does seem like the answers are just at your fingertips. What gets lost in all of this is the family. Deborah, her children, and even Jesse herself. For over 30 years, they've endured the frustration, the pain, the loss, and the grief. They've watched investigators claim that the evidence is there while lawyers debate about its dependability. Perhaps most frustrating is the manner in which all of this was handled, as pertains to Deborah herself. A sheriff who gets frustrated and makes a threat, empty or not, to pull investigators off the case. A solicitor who has little to say other than he doesn't see enough evidence to prosecute. While it's difficult from an outsider's perspective to truly understand all the different facets in this case, let alone all of the details about the investigation, what could be used, what couldn't, it just feels like this poor woman got pushed to the side, and so did her daughter. How hard would you fight if a loved one disappeared? I know there are parents listening right now. What limits would you allow to be placed on you in pursuit of recovering your child? It's a highly emotional situation that was handled poorly, and the way it was handled may speak volumes about the integrity of the investigation itself. How many hours, how many days worth of valuable time were lost due to these interdepartmental disputes? It certainly doesn't make things look better when the sheriff later loses his job and pleads guilty to charges of accepting bribes. Donnie Meyer's time as solicitor ended when he announced he wouldn't seek re-election in 2016 following a DUI arrest. When it comes down to the theories, there's not a lot to work with. This case, this discussion, really becomes about the manner in which the investigation was handled and what was missed or left behind. What opportunities were lost, and what exactly is needed for charges to finally be filed? That's not a question for me, unfortunately, and I'll tell you right now, I'm not an investigator. I don't have to hop through the red tape and legal hoops that law enforcement has to adhere to. But it's really difficult to accept how things have turned out thus far. It's amazing how a set of egos can divert an entire investigation at the cost of a child. So we've got two theories. Starting with the first theory, we look at Deborah's ex-boyfriend. According to statements made by Deborah in various news articles, her relationship with this man had been on the rocks for a while. There was a concern about his behavior in terms of seeming to be controlling. There was absolutely concerns when it came to his predilection for alcohol, and eventually Deborah had enough. Not long before Jesse was abducted, Deborah told this man she wanted him out of her life, that things were over. It's hard not to look at the man suspiciously when her youngest child goes missing not long after. Basically, since the beginning, Deborah has believed that this man was involved in Jesse's abduction. She called him the same day that she filed the missing persons report. She told investigators about her suspicions, and he was spoken to by law enforcement on several occasions. How far those conversations went, whether or not a polygraph was ever presented, I couldn't tell you. But it isn't all that out of the ordinary for a significant other, or ex-significant other, to be looked at suspiciously in a case such as this. Depending on who you ask, it seems apparent that this wasn't random. Whoever entered the home didn't go and grab the first person they came across. They didn't try to steal items. They took Jesse, the four-year-old, the one who would be the lightest to carry and the easiest to control, out of the bed in which she was laying next to her six-year-old sister. This guy didn't accidentally walk into Deborah's room. He went straight to the children's room. He came in through a window, he left through the front door, and he left the door wide open behind him. Just calm and casual, like it didn't mean anything. I don't really understand why there were papers all over the floor or how he managed to pull the curtains off the wall. I guess maybe he stumbled while he was coming in through the window, but either way, it seems pretty clear that this guy had a target and a goal, and once he executed it, he left. Meanwhile, Jesse's sister witnesses the man taking Jesse and is so traumatized and overcome by fear that she can't even make a sound. I read in an interview with her years later that she was so petrified that she just pulled the blanket up over her head and hoped the man would go away. And then it just becomes a mystery. Where was she taken? What happened to her? Why was she taken in the first place? I thought it was interesting in one of the quotes I read to you from former Sheriff Metz, where he said that he thought the child had been taken for a reason, and when that reason didn't work out, the abductor panicked and killed Jesse. That's not entirely out of the realm of possibility, though I feel like if the abduction was for a purpose and the murder was a knee-jerk reaction, it takes a special kind of sick person to go from kidnapping a child to just murdering her on a whim. She was four. There wasn't much she could give to investigators to help track down her abductor. The guy could have just left her at a church or anywhere. He didn't have to kill her. Unless maybe he believed she could ID him. And maybe she could, because maybe she recognized him. There hasn't been much discussion about this case, so it's difficult to ascertain certain facts. I'd love to have a discussion about it with law enforcement or the family, but I can't help wondering about the abductor's face. We know from Becky that she saw the man. There was the hat, described as a magic hat, which we'll get more into in theory too. There was apparently a beard. In one interview years later, Becky has said that she sees the man's face every night before she goes to bed. I want to know if she sees the actual face or the memory of it. You know how when something traumatic happens, things can blur? You're talking a six-year-old frightened in the middle of the night in a dark room. Does she remember a distinct face, or did trauma and memory sort of warp it? I'd imagine it wasn't a face she recognized, or perhaps one she just didn't get a full look at. It's kind of hard to imagine that the boyfriend could go in and out without being recognized, but your mind does strange things when you're scared, and coupled with her age, I don't think there's any way Becky could have been much help in IDing the abductor. Unfortunately for her, she still carries the weight of that guilt, feeling like she could have done more. That's not a pain that will easily be assuaged, but I do hope she has found peace enough inside to recognize that she was just a child and there's little she could have done. If she had screamed out, if she had gotten attention, maybe Jesse wouldn't have been taken, but maybe something worse would have happened. I try to apply facts and logic to the theories when I examine them, so I've got to go on what we know. The ex-boyfriend was questioned multiple times and claimed innocence. Deborah spoke to him, and he denied involvement. As far as I can find, no evidence has ever been found to link him to that crime. The fingerprint wasn't his, we know that much. No one's ever come forward and claimed he admitted to anything, and while he may not have a clean rap sheet with police, he obviously didn't have any crimes before or after the abduction that they felt would warrant really digging into him. But the other guy did, and that brings us to the second theory. In some articles, this guy has been referred to as a family friend. In others, he's been called an acquaintance. What information is public about him is limited. But we do know he was from West Columbia, stole at least one vehicle in his life, committed at least one rape, is a registered sex offender, and has done time in North Carolina. What really draws me into this guy, other than the fact that both Deborah and law enforcement zeroed in on him really early on in the investigation, is the alleged confession. There's certainly a lot of cases out there of false confessions, of people lying for whatever reason. It's difficult to imagine the rules are much different when the guy is supposedly telling someone he shares a cell with. People say all sorts of things in prison to build up their reputation, though it's usually unwise to admit to committing a crime against a child. Even in prison, they don't take kindly to people who victimize children. So why tell that story if it wasn't true? It's difficult to verify the exact statement. The solicitor's office nor the sheriff's department have ever fully confirmed it. The story we have is that this guy, after telling his cellmate, was interviewed by members of law enforcement and at the time requested immunity for the crime should he tell the truth. We all know that no one's going to offer immunity for a child abduction and murder in exchange for telling the details of that abduction and murder. That was never going to fly. And while I'd love to know what happened here, I certainly wouldn't be willing to exchange a free walk for the crime just to find out. Apparently, that's where the conversation ended. We know from the cellmate that the guy claimed to have disposed of Jesse's body in a landfill, though that landfill was searched to no result. Was she ever there? Could she still be there? It's almost impossible to say. What sticks for me is the fingerprint. You've got this guy's fingerprint on the window that was forced open for the abductor to gain access. No one else's fingerprint, just his. You've got the story he supposedly told, and then you've got one added detail, that he allegedly wore a cowboy hat the night he committed the crime. Could that be the magic hat? Personally, I pictured a top hat. That's what I think of when I think of a magic hat. In my research, I found a Canadian show called Harriet's Magic Hats, in which a woman owns a series of hats, and when a child puts one on, they're transported to a place related to that hat. The first episode of season 3 of that show, which aired in 1985, was called Rodeo and involved a magic cowboy hat. While that's interesting, the show appears to have only been broadcast in Canada. I can't find any evidence that it ever played in the States, but I thought that was an interesting connection. I don't have children, and even as a child, I didn't really watch too many children's shows, so maybe some of you out there listening might have an idea of what a magic hat could be. Maybe when you hear that, a specific hat pops into your mind. I'd really like to hear about it. I would love nothing more than to tell you there's enough evidence, but there wasn't. And while I might be frustrated with the investigation, I can't necessarily blame the solicitor for not prosecuting. I don't know that a jury would convict a man of child abduction based purely on his fingerprint being on the window, especially when he might have known the family and could claim that he'd been there before, so there's just a chance his fingerprints would be there. I know that's frustrating, but if I were on a jury and all you had was a fingerprint, I don't know whether I could vote guilty or not. The alleged confession probably wouldn't have been admissible. Whether or not this guy's arrest record could be read in the trial, I don't know. But there's a lot of pieces of a puzzle here, but not the biggest piece necessary to fully understand the picture. I suppose what I need to do at this time is ask you. What do you think based on the information you've heard? But it's really a twofold question before you answer it. The first half would be whether or not you think this guy likely committed the crime. But the second would be, if you were sitting on a jury and the only evidence you had was the fingerprint, could you vote guilty? Now, there's obviously other evidence in this case, evidence which has never been revealed to the public. What it was that was sent to the FBI for analysis, I've never discovered, and there's no further discussion of it. The fibers found in the vehicle by Deborah herself, what were they connected to? What analysis, if any, was run on them? How was the vehicle they were found in connected to this guy, and how much time had passed between the abduction and the discovery of those fibers? All questions I'd love to have the answers to, but there don't appear to be any answers right now. Two men, two possibilities. Only one has ever been considered a person of interest, and that man has served time for horrible crimes. He spent time around North and South Carolina since then. There was an issue with him failing to register as a sex offender in South Carolina, as he's required to. No matter what way you slice it, this is a guy who could have legitimate connections to this case if only the evidence necessary could be found, if only someone else could come forward. If this guy's the type to run his mouth about his crimes, and it certainly seems that he is, then why hasn't he done it again since? I'll bet he has. I can't begin to fathom what this must be like for Deborah and her children, the difficulty they must deal with day in and day out. The pain, the anger, the hurt, and the loss. It's a complicated story with a lot of different angles, but few that make sense. It's an investigation that certainly has its issues, and in the years following Jesse's abduction, The family needed the strength and support of law enforcement, not the disregard and threats. This investigation has holes in it. There are some problems here, but it's not too late. Someone out there knows what happened. Someone out there has the answers. And in an instant, one of those people could bring an end to this horrible situation and grant closure to this battered family. Since the initial investigation couldn't get the job done, I guess that leaves things up to the current investigators, the family, and all of you. You have the power to give this case attention. You have the ability to spread the word about it, and we all have the ability to stand beside Deborah in her search for justice. All it takes is for the right person to hear the right thing, for the right person to pick up a phone, send an email, leave an anonymous tip. This is a case that has for so long balanced on the edge of a knife, and only the slightest gust of wind is necessary to get the ball rolling again. This case is 100% solvable. It may be the most solvable case I've ever covered. I can only hope that that resolution is coming, that the answers will be found, and that Jesse's family might find comfort in discovering the truth and seeing justice done.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and
conditions. 18 plus. If you're looking for more information about the abduction of Jessica Gutierrez, there are many websites and forums discussing her case. TheState.com and WIS News 10 were invaluable resources for this episode, and as always, links to their articles will be found on the website. If you want to dig into the case a bit yourself, you could start with the DOE Network, where Jessica's case number is 173-DFSC. She's also in NCMEC number 601-626 and on NamUs, MP6152. If you have any information about the abduction of Jessica Gutierrez, please contact the Lexington County Sheriff's Office at 803-785-8230. You can also contact the Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Now it's time to thank our amazing Patreon producers. I've updated the list this month. If you think your name should be here and you don't hear it, please contact me. Patreon is notoriously bad for the way that it organized the lists of patrons, so I may have missed someone. I'll be happy to correct that. But for this month's Patreon producers, a special thank you goes to Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Angie Dodd, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerard Lopez Barbosa, Julia Rexon, Kate Alexander, Kelly Cohen, Laura Dickinson, Lisa Holly, Linda Halcrow, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Randy Wyland, Robbie Blue, Chandra Moreau, Samantha Ford, Thea Vandenberg, Tom Archer, and Wannabe Sleuth 2. You're all fantastically amazing, and I am deeply indebted to your graciousness. One last note before the end of the show. There's a good chance that come January, I'm going to be looking to hire a researcher. The podcast is finally in a position where I could be able to bring on an employee, and I would love to hire somebody who has experience doing research, who loves true crime, and who is detail-oriented as I am. So in the coming weeks, probably in episode 100, but more than likely in episodes before that, I'll provide some kind of information on how you can apply for that position or send me a resume or something along those lines. But if it's something that you might be interested in, take some time, think about it, and the opportunity will be coming.
I want to thank you all for listening. You have no idea how much it means to me, and anyone out there listening right now, you might be the key to solving one of these cases. So that's going to do it for this week's episode, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
So did you like this voice? Should I do this voice more often? Should I do the whole show this way from now
on? Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Thanks for listening, everyone.